Hi, I'm Mark Brody, co-host of The Show, one of KJZZ's original productions. It's a program with news and features from across Phoenix and the state. You can find much more at theshow.kjzz.org. Here's today's episode.
Good morning, and welcome to The Show. On KJZZ 91.5 FM in Phoenix, I'm Sam Dingman.
And I'm Mark Brody. Coming up, the J.D. Vance media narrative, why Trump supporters hear a different story than the one Democrats are telling.
And how the valley's increasing density is changing the region.
But first, it seems like school starts earlier every year. Many kids across Arizona are already in back-to-school mode now at the beginning of August. And it is hot, much hotter than summers past, with records being broken each year. So how are Arizona schools keeping kids cool on buses and in classrooms in the hottest parts of the state? To find out, we got a hold of Cole Young, superintendent of the Mojave Valley School District, a rural district northwest of the valley not far from Needles, California, which just broke Phoenix's record for the hottest monthly temperature in a U.S. city this July. He spoke more about all this with our co-host Lauren Gilger, beginning with more about Mojave Valley.
So we're kind of in the Tri-City area when it comes to Needles and Laughlin, Bullhead City, and we're just 17 miles south of Bullhead City. So Death Valley is only 2 hours away. We've got about 1,400 kids. We're a K-8 school district.
You mentioned you're not far from Death Valley, so we should not assume that because you're a little further north than us in the state of Arizona that it is not very hot there, I'm assuming.
It is. We get plenty of heat. When we have a day that's under 100, we think it's a very cool day. Maybe time for a shawl or something. You know, it's
And is it like we're seeing here in the valley? Are schools opening, starting earlier in the year? I mean, many kids in Phoenix and the area here have already started school, and it's barely August.
Yeah. Shazam. We're on day four ourselves.
Wow.
So we are already navigating buses being out in this heat and making sure that kids are taken care of and not leaving them at bus stops too long and making sure HVACs are up and running. But really, there's no landing gear on this plane. So we continue to monitor that all summer long with our summer programs and pieces of that nature.
Yeah. So talk about that. The challenges that starting school in late July, early August, like the depths of the very hot Arizona summer, right? What does that
Absolutely.
Mean in terms of schools and infrastructure and funding?
No, it's a difficult challenge because we have in our school district roughly 130, 140 air conditioners that range from 1997 all the way up until current. And so as you look at those older models, albeit that they tried and true, it's not if, it's when they go down. So we're constantly monitoring that piece. So those are challenges in our area.
Do you see them give out after, you know, being operating for 20, 30 years here often?
Absolutely.
Do you have the money to replace them?
Well, that's an interesting question. Yes and no, because we used to have school facilities in which we had monies for building renewal. That's no longer in Arizona. We now go through the school's facilities division. And that means that we have to request monies through an emergency. But when it's 124 degrees out, when you think Phoenix, you think hot. But when you think Mojave Valley, in your car, you'll get in, it'll be 132 degrees.
Wow.
It'll be 124 out. So the dependency we have on making sure we expedite changing out air conditioners is huge when it comes to our infrastructure and keeping kids out of the heat.
Man, yeah. You mentioned school buses. I know there have been complaints on school buses from parents. Are you able to keep those cool on sometimes longer rides?
It's a great question. Yes and no, because, you know, that's a tin can. And when it's 125 out, you have to feel like what is appropriate, what isn't. It, you know, if we can get those buses down to 85 degrees, we've won the day. But it mm-hmm. doesn't feel like that. So very difficult to do that. We actually won an EPA clean bus grant. We have electric buses that are coming and are supposedly handle the air conditioning much better.
So do you get complaints from parents, worries from parents, complaints from kids about the heat? Do you just try to keep them inside all day? How do you deal with it?
Well, you know, we look at the heat index and we kind of gravitate around that 100 to 110. And then we try to monitor the amount of time in which they're out, the access to hydration, making sure that they're taking care of the wellness is number one overall. So it's just dependent on the day and how much humidity and how high the temperature index really is.
Are there some challenges here you think that are unique to rural school districts that we might not see in schools here in the valley?
Absolutely. When it comes to just the infrastructure of vendors, you got to remember this is tax season for them, all those HVAC companies. We're not the only ones that HVACs are going down. So when we compete to try to get our HVACs replaced, we're leaning on the same vendors over and over again to try to make that happen. And in the most part, they have done a phenomenal job, but, the procurement process kind of wears out our vendors when it comes to making sure we have three quotes and then they don't get it and they have to quote again. So there is definite challenges in making sure that we keep the community going as well as all of our schools.
So talk a little bit lastly here, Cole, just about what you need. Like, is this a funding problem? Is it a staffing problem? What would make it easier?
You know, I think that if we truly had the opportunity to look at the air conditioners that we have and be able to say they need to be when you look at a 25-year-old air conditioner, I feel like if the state would say instead it has to break, if there was a threshold or reserve study that would allow us to change it out before it fails, because inevitably it doesn't fail during the summer. We keep them on all year long because we're afraid to shut them down. But if we could get items replaced before they fail, when we know they're going to, that would help us out immensely.
30-year-old air conditioners, yeah. All right.
Yeah.
We'll leave it there for now. Cole Young, superintendent of the Mojave Valley School District, joining us to talk about the challenges of going back to school in this heat. Cole, thank you for coming on. Appreciate it very much.
Absolutely, Lauren. Thank you.
Not long after J.D. Vance was announced as Donald Trump's running mate, he started making the wrong kind of headlines. It started at his first rally with a joke about racist soda that didn't land, despite the fact that he was speaking to a hometown crowd in Ohio. And it didn't get better from there, as old videos of his controversial views about childless Americans began to emerge, along with unfavorable comparisons of his charisma to that of the man at the top of the ticket. And last week, the online chatter became a national conversation as major news networks and newspaper headlines started openly questioning how carefully Trump had thought about his choice of Vance. And in the midst of all this, the Trump campaign announced that Vance was coming to Arizona for a rally. So I grabbed my recording kit and headed up to Glendale. Show producer Nick Sanchez and I are walking across the parking lot at Arizona Christian University in Glendale. We're on our way to a rally with Senator J.D. Vance, the Republican nominee for vice president. As we pass a parked car, a guy in a MAGA hat calls out to us.
You see any snipers? Yell, right? I mean, yell loudly.
Try.
Okay,
try.
Thanks.
Oh, right, I think. Snipers. I realize I haven't even considered the fact that it's only been about 2 weeks since someone tried to assassinate former President Donald Trump. And now Nick and I are casually strolling into a rally for the other guy on Trump's ticket. Shouldn't we be a little more freaked out? The truth is, the idea of snipers never even crossed my mind before we got in the car. Not because I'm some kind of tough guy, but because I had kind of forgotten about the whole assassination attempt. Somehow that story has been almost completely overshadowed by a single word. Weird.
These are weird people on the other side. They want to take books away. They want to be in your exam room. That's what it comes down to. And don't, you know, get sugarcoating this. These are weird ideas. Listen to them speak.
I'm a lot of things, but weird I'm not. And I'm up front. And he's not either, I will tell you. J.D. is not at all. They are.
He and his running mate sure seem to have a lot to say about me. And by the way, don't you find some of their stuff to just be plain weird?
From the moment it was uttered by Minnesota Governor Tim Walz in an appearance on MSNBC, weird has become a ubiquitous line of attack against Republicans and Senator Vance in particular. On social media, Democrats have dredged up old comments from Vance denigrating childless cat ladies. They have amplified false rumors that he had sex with a couch, made fun of him for allegedly wearing eyeliner, and cackled with glee when the sign on his podium kept falling off at one of his rallies. Many of these social media posts went viral, and by the middle of last week, headlines began to appear suggesting that Trump was considering dropping Vance from the ticket.
which is why Nick and I are standing in line for the Vance rally. We want to see how Trump supporters are feeling about all this.
A lot of people have been using the word weird to talk about J.D. Vance. Have you seen those stories?
I have saw that.
What do you make of those?
I don't understand it. I don't know why somebody would think he was weird. Maybe they're weird.
I'm a little weird. People think I'm weird. They, you know, think maybe I'm gay because I've never been married. It's because, or don't have kids. I've never found the right man, so I never had children. Weird is good. I don't know why they're doing it.
I think everybody is weird. Like, who cares?
What's
like,
weird? Right?
Maybe you think I'm weird because I have pink pants on. Maybe I think you're weird because you have pants on at all. I don't know. Whatever.
Now, to be clear, I was not really expecting anyone who would attend a J.D. Vance rally to buy into a Democratic line of attack against J.D. Vance. But I did wonder if anyone here would be worried. Most people agreed that this is going to be a really close election. Maybe Trump voters were seeing the headlines and thinking Vance had become a liability. But they weren't. The people we talked to don't think J.D. Vance is weird at all. In fact, they find him relatable.
Seems like a good old boy. He talks about his meemaw. I kind of like that. I think he's down to earth.
Having people that love you and are your shepherds. We all need good shepherds in our lives. And by the grace of God, I think Mama was probably the one key for him. She held it together at a critical time in his life. I get inspired to be the best shepherd I can be for other people.
The way he grew up and what he was able to overcome and do with it, I'm always a big one for the underdog, people who are facing insurmountable odds, you know, in their lives. And they have that grit and that determination. And I think that's what I truly appreciate about him. And it just gives me a good feeling.
That is a far cry from the cringy, awkward version of Vance being pushed by Democrats on social media. This is a version of J.D. Vance created by J.D. Vance himself in his memoir, Hillbilly Elegy, which was also adapted into a film. Hillbilly Elegy tells the story of Vance as a young boy, growing up with an abusive mom who struggles with addiction.
J.D., I've been looking all over for you. Need you to piss in this. Got a call from the nursing board. I have to give him a sample by the end of the day.
A sample?
I gotta give him clean piss, and Mama's got 100 prescriptions in hers.
Why isn't yours clean?
Just do it, okay?
Why isn't yours clean?
Come on now, go do it!
No!
Please!
As a teenager, Vance seems destined for a similar fate, until his foul-mouthed, gun-toting grandmother, who he calls Mama, pulls Vance out of his mother's house and sets him on the straight and narrow.
Why do you even want me?
Who said I wanted you?
I really hate you, you know that?
I don't care you hate me. I ain't in it for popularity. You gotta take care of business. You gotta go to school. You gotta get good grades to even have a chance.
With Mama's help, Vance gets out of small-town Ohio. He becomes a Marine and then a student at Yale Law School. At one point, he goes to a fancy dinner with a bunch of refined Ivy League types, and he haltingly tells the story of his humble beginnings.
Well, I'm from Ohio, but my family is from Kentucky.
Bluegrass State.
Yes, sir. I joined the Marines out of high school, served in Iraq.
Wow.
Yeah, it was a great experience. You know, I helped pay for college.
It's the American dream, right?
Exactly.
As Vance speaks, he watches everyone else at the table avert their eyes, staring down at their plates. He can tell. They think he's weird.
It must feel like you're from another planet.
Yeah, you know, I guess.
Towards the end of the movie, Vance's mom suffers a drug relapse, but she refuses to go to rehab. Vance drives 10 hours from New Haven to Ohio and checks her into a hotel. But he only has a few hours before he has to turn around and drive all the way back to Yale for an interview at a prestigious law firm. He and his mom sit quietly together on the hotel bed.
I love you, Mom. I want you to get better.
No.
Okay, to be happy. And I'll help you. I'll do everything I can.
okay.
Back in Glendale, at the rally, Vance takes the stage.
Please, please, thank you all. It is so fantastic to be in Arizona. I am. Well, in 96 days, my friends, we're going to take back our country and elect Donald J. Trump, President of the United States.
Much of his speech is standard Republican fare, resulting in polite applause.
And the Democrat Party bosses, they've decided to install Kamala Harris as their new nominee. But think about this. She has not received a single vote for President of the United States. Now, the media calls this a coronation. I think we'd call it a coup. And in America, we don't crown...
But when Vance pivots to his own story, he finds his voice. And the room gets loud.
Now, people ask, why did it work out for you? And a little bit of it's luck. A little bit of it is that we live in the greatest country in the world where big dreams are still possible, whatever side of the tracks you grew up on. But a little of it, if I'm being honest, is because I had a tough old bird, my grandmother, I called her Mamaw, who stood by me every step of the way.
Now,
after the rally, I meet a woman in the parking lot named Tammy. She's grinning ear to ear. So can you describe your shirt for me?
My shirt says Badass Hillbilly 2024.
And is that a reference to Senator Vance?
It is. It is. And I relate a lot because I have family from Kentucky. My dad's a hillbilly. And I'm out of recovery, so I'm a lot like J.D. Vance's mother. And so seeing his movie was cool because it showed me the side of what my kids went through. You know what I mean? It was nice to see, and it was nice to see somebody comes from people like us.
For KJZZ's The Show, I'm Sam Dingman.
Good morning. It's The Show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Mark Brody.
And I'm Sam Dingman. Coming up, do any of us really understand how America works?
It's really striking just how little basic knowledge of civics Americans have. Questions about the First Amendment, separation of powers, federalism, things like that.
An author tells us how our understanding of civic processes, or lack thereof, affects political culture.
But first...
There is one uranium mine near the Grand Canyon, and the company that runs it just started hauling the product across the Navajo Nation's land last week. That prompted quick and passionate objections from the Navajo Nation, and now Governor Katie Hobbs has stepped in to negotiate a compromise. And it's all happening in front of a global backdrop of growing demand for uranium, as the Biden administration and other world powers have promised to triple nuclear capacity in their effort to fight climate change. KJZZ's Indigenous Affairs reporter Gabrielle Pietrazio has been following the story and joins us now in studio to talk more about it. Good morning, Gabe.
Morning, Lauren.
Okay, so let's start with some of the background here. We're talking about the Pinyon Plain Mine. This is maybe 10 miles from the Grand Canyon. I know you've been in it. Why was this mine allowed to operate so close to the Grand Canyon to begin with? Like, that's been banned for a long time, right?
For sure. To give you a bit of context, it's actually on Forest Service lands within the Kaibab National Forest. Operation actually hadn't started until around December, January, at the start of this year, essentially. Mm-hmm. And so the company has been extracting uranium ore. They've been building to this moment to contract essentially trucks that would then take it off the Forest Service lands and through its pre-approved haul route, which encompasses the Navajo Nation on its way to Blanding, Utah. Interestingly enough, this mine is the only one that is operational near the Grand Canyon because of Biden's national monument designation from last August, actually. Right. And so that ceased temporarily uranium claims in the future. This one was grandfathered in by the 1872 mining law.
Yeah. Okay. So they've started mining, and then just last week they start hauling this uranium, as you said, on a pre-approved route, and they haul it across the Navajo Nation's land. This is really controversial, it turns out. So tell us why. Like, what are the environmental, the health concerns related to moving this product across Navajo land?
I think the biggest challenge from everyone that I'm hearing and speaking to is this legacy when it comes to uranium mining. Specifically, we have over 500 abandoned uranium mines that have yet to be cleaned up by the federal government. This is part of an older generation, an era of uranium mining, Energy Fuels, the company says, but that legacy is still impacting people today. I think that's the biggest fear and concern. We also saw this summer RECA, the Radiation Exposure Compensation Act, expiring, which provided compensation to those who were affected by uranium and downwinders. And so this history hasn't been resolved for the people there. But the other issue is they're trucking through areas that are somewhat populated. And so the concern is that if there's dust that comes off those vehicles, that's the major issue at hand. Obviously, if there's a road accident, that's also another concern. Emergency responses, how prompt are they to answer? But I think the biggest concerns are the dust. From the scientists who I've spoken to, the handling of uranium ore, which I did at Pinyon Plain Mine, is relatively low for the radioactive risks that are associated to it. But it, what matters is if you breathe in those dust particles, that's how people got the lung diseases that we saw during the 1940s, 50s, 60s when the uranium mining on the Navajo Nation was really bad.
Right. Okay. So what are Navajo officials saying about this and why they do not want this to happen?
Well, going back to 2012, we had the Radioactive and Related Substances Equipment, Vehicles, Persons, and Materials Transportation Act. That's a mouthful.
Yes, it is.
It's basically their 2012 law that the Navajo Nation Council passed, and it basically banned the hauling of uranium, excluding uranium waste materials that are being remediated on the land through the reservation, essentially. And so leaders like Navajo Nation President Boo Nigrin, who I spoke to last Tuesday, just hours after the trucking began, when he was notified, he had this to say.
We gave you right-of-ways to build state routes, but it's still our lands. These are the boundaries of the Navajo Nation, and that's what you respect first. Don't take advantage of that and not even give us a heads up. So you are guests. If you're not going to uphold and respect our laws, we want nothing to do with you.
So it sounds like, Gabe, that for them, this is also about tribal sovereignty.
Exactly. I think that from the people that I hear and speak to, leaders, they see it as their laws aren't being respected. Even though they gave up the right of ways for these state and federal highways to be built and constructed through them, as President Nigrin said, you know, they're seen as guests.
What has the company had to say about all of this? Have they responded?
They have. They've expressed that unlike what the county, Coconino County, and neighboring tribes like Navajo Nation and the Havasupai have claimed, that the company promised to give a 2 weeks notice ahead of the hauling, they expressed that they're not legally required to, nor did they give such a promise to those stakeholders along the haul route. And I spoke to Energy Fuels President and CEO Mark Chalmers recently on this issue of transparency with another tribe that's near the White Mesa Mill, Mountain Ute Tribe, who had expressed concern that they don't know what's being hauled to the mill and they're not notified about when it occurs. And this is what he had to say when asked about transparency and whether they should notify the public about these shipments.
To notify the public of every shipment that is being made in and out would take a lot of work, and I think people would get bored.
Okay, so now we have Governor Katie Hobbs stepping in late last week, and she's got the company basically to agree to pause this hauling of uranium and negotiate some kind of agreement with the Navajo Nation. What happened here? Like, was this who we expected to step in?
Certainly not. I was not expecting Governor Katie Hobbs on Thursday evening to send out a statement saying that they brokered this trucking truce. I don't think anyone was really, except those who were in the room when it happened. But what is interesting is this isn't really entirely enforceable by any sort of legal statute whatsoever. The state has minimal control over what it can and can't do. Governor Katie Hobbs does have some sort of authorities to review mining permits and claims and the aquifer protection permit that Pinyon Plain Mine has to operate. And maybe that, what we're hearing from some sources, might be a way that they're bringing them to the table, so to speak, to make sure that they're in compliance with their standards that they tout. But otherwise, she doesn't have much authority, nor does the state really, in managing or overseeing this process, since this is a federal jurisdictional issue.
So if they do come to an agreement here between the company and the tribe, what might that look like? Like, what are the possibilities? Do you think that this will be the end of it?
certainly this isn't the end of this discussion, this conversation. The Navajo Nation for the last few months has been working through its attorney general's office to establish regulations that would guide how the nation would require the company Energy Fuels to haul through its reservation. One of the major concerns has been what times. A big concern is schools and whether there's buses on the highways. Another issue would be establishing inspection stations and sites where Navajo Nation police and or other officials can go and inspect these vehicles. They want to establish fees, which would make it more expensive for them to haul the uranium ore through the reservation, possibly to find an alternative route.
Are you expecting this to end up in court still, Gabe?
The Navajo Nation President Boo Nigrin, he said to me recently in our call, he says, we'll see you in court. Mm-hmm. And to me, that implies that the federal court will have to come in and possibly adjudicate on this issue. There's been talks that basically the Navajo Nation is going to test this tribal law that they have and to see to what effect do they have the sovereignty to do so, mm-hmm. to enforce it.
All right. Lots to watch for then. KJZZ's Indigenous Affairs reporter Gabriel Pietrazio joining us. Gabe, thanks as always. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Live from NPR News in Boston, I'm Steve Brown. Vice President Kamala Harris has picked Minnesota Governor Tim Walz to be her running mate. Harris says in a post on social media that Walz has delivered for working families. The two will appear together tonight in Philadelphia at an evening rally. The 60-year-old Midwestern governor, military veteran, and union supporter has helped enact an ambitious Democratic agenda for his state, including sweeping protections for abortion rights and aid to families. Tropical storm Debbie has moved menacingly into some of America's most historic southern cities, bringing torrential downpours and flooding after slamming into Florida with heavy rain and high winds. Record-setting rain from the storm that killed at least five people was causing flash flooding in Savannah, Georgia, and Charleston, South Carolina, among other areas of the Atlantic coast. Savannah Mayor Van Johnson told residents to hunker down and expect a rough day today. The National Transportation Safety Board is holding a two-day hearing into the blowout of a panel from the side of a Boeing 737 MAX airliner. It will hear from witnesses, including its own investigators, who have been looking into the January 5th accident that occurred during an Alaska Airlines flight. The Safety Board's hearing began today in Washington, D.C.
Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5 FM. I'm Sam Dingman.
And I'm Mark Brody. Growth in the Phoenix area is not a new concept, but over the past several years, there's been a renewed focus on increasing density in some valley cities. Building cranes in downtowns across the region would seem to bear that out. John Talton is a fourth-generation Arizonan who now lives in Seattle. He's watched the metro area grow out and now up. Talton is an Arizona historian. He writes a blog on the subject called Rogue Columnist. He's also a former columnist for the Arizona Republic and now writes for the Seattle Times. I spoke with him earlier about this, and we started with how many of the changes he has seen over the years here does he think would have happened anyway, and how much of it is due to the wants of residents as opposed to needs.
I think it's entirely regarding wants. If we never would have won the Central Arizona Project, of which my mother was a part of that effort to win it, we never would have had 4 million people in the Phoenix metropolitan area, and we never would have lost what was called American Eden, which was the Salt River Valley that exported prime and very coveted grapefruits, oranges, lemons, dates. Everything would grow here, and it was sent in refrigerated railroad boxcars as far east as New York City.
When you talk about, you know, this being something that people wanted, I mean, that by definition, that kind of means that it was a popular decision, at least to some people, that, you know, people wanted to be able to live in a place that was maybe they could walk to work or walk to a restaurant or walk to entertainment, things like that. I guess, how big of a surprise is it that Phoenix has, at least parts of it, have turned into a place where that is possible, whereas in earlier years, it almost would have been unthinkable?
That has been a long time coming. the people who wanted this were mostly the real estate interests, the developers, and all of the associations and people who benefit from real estate development. We built a huge freeway system, which made land that was otherwise not very valuable, very valuable, to build tract house subdivisions for miles and miles and miles and miles. None of this would have been possible without the CAP. And now we're in a situation where we're probably unsustainable. Now, as far as density goes, as I say, it's been a long time coming. Thanks to light rail, there's been a lot of filling in along Central Avenue and in downtown, midtown, where I have a condo, and uptown. There's been more density in Tempe, and there's been more density in what is now Old Scottsdale, which used to just be Scottsdale.
Well, so you mentioned the word sustainable, and I wonder if in some ways having more density makes this area a little more sustainable, at least as far as maybe as an antidote to some of the sprawl that so many people have been complaining about for years.
Well, my theory is that Phoenix's survival will depend on pulling back into the footprint of the Salt River Project and having very high quality, high density, served by abundant transit, instead of building out at Douglas Ranch and beyond the White Tanks and all of these other real estate hustles that are going on.
Well, it's an interesting point, because if you are to build sort of in the original footprint of the Salt River Project and sort of in the original footprint of what the city is, that would almost necessitate more density, right? Like, you need to be able to build up and not out in those areas because there just isn't as much open space.
Well, that's why I say high quality density. Paris has very high quality density. London has very high quality density. Seattle has very high quality density.
So what would high quality density look like to you in Phoenix?
Well, it would mean preserving the historic districts and preserving their shade trees and oleander hedges and grass, because that keeps the area cool. It would mean in the center part of the city, maintaining and building more and planting rather more and more shade trees. And I don't mean Palo Verdes, real shade trees. And then abundant condos and apartments, and preserving areas such as Arcadia. Nobody has to fear this. It doesn't have to be some kind of scam to make people be dependent on transit and take away their ability to drive. But they need to have options. And so along the light rail lines, we can have abundant high density, and people don't have to drive if they choose not to.
I'm curious about sort of the disparity between the image of the Phoenix area as, you know, one big, basically series of sprawled out neighborhoods that just goes out and out and out for miles. And to some extent, you know, there are parts of town that really are very far away from the city center. But we're also, as we've been discussing, are seeing in certain cities more of a desire to build up the urban core. Is it sustainable? Is it a problem, do you think, to have sort of both of those in the same metro area? Or is that just something that Phoenix has and maybe the area should embrace?
Well, I don't think the area should embrace it, because the temperature, the overnight temperature, has gone up about 10 degrees in my lifetime. And as for the fringes of the city, some of them may make themselves sustainable, but there has to be the political will and the popular support to make it happen.
So do you see this kind of thing continuing? Do you see this trend of more building in urban cores in the Phoenix metro area continuing into the future?
I do, and I hope it happens, because the alternative is not going to be good, not only as local warming increases because of all the concrete and gravel that's being thrown down, but as global warming intensifies, and Phoenix is the bullseye in global warming, human-caused climate change.
John Talton, thank you so much for your time. Thanks for your insights. I appreciate it.
All right. Bye, Mark.
Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5 FM. I'm Sam Dingman.
And I'm Mark Brody. There has been a lot of conversation over the past few years about how polarized and divided we are as a country. But my next guest says the problem isn't necessarily one side of the political aisle or other, but rather us. William Cooper is an attorney and columnist. His new book is called How America Works and Why It Doesn't. I spoke with him earlier about this, and we started with whether Cooper thinks people in this country, or outside the country for that matter, really understand how and why this country works and why sometimes it doesn't.
I think the first question, do people understand how this country works? Unfortunately, the percentage is dwindling. People are less and less interested in the core functions of how the country works. And that's something I talk about in the first half of the book. And then the second half of the book, following your question, is do people understand why it's not working? And that's what I focus there. I think if you talk to people about how the country's not working, and I think a majority of Americans would agree with that, you're going to get a lot of different views. I've got my views, but I think if you ask that question to 10 people, you'd probably get 10 different answers.
On that first question of how America works, is that a matter of needing better civics education? Is there something more that needs to be happening here to get people to really understand how this country functions?
You're exactly right. Civics is key. And if you look at the polling, the University of Pennsylvania Annenberg School of Communications does an annual poll, and they show data. It's really striking just how little basic knowledge of civics Americans have. Questions about the First Amendment, separation of powers, federalism, things like that. The numbers are really striking. You get, you know, well below half the country in that poll kind of understanding the basics. And I think that's a real problem. It doesn't immediately cause huge harm right out of the gate. But over time, as more and more Americans are focusing on other things instead of the workings of the country, I think it can have a really negative impact.
Does it lead to the kind of impact where maybe it goes to the second part of the question here, why this country doesn't always work the way it should?
Exactly. And Donald Trump post-election behavior is a great example of that. In my view, he, after the election, was essentially at war with perhaps the most fundamental principle of how America works, which is the peaceful transfer of power. And yet, despite the fact that there was a violation of that key essential principle, he's again the Republican nominee, and he's still extremely popular and an extremely potent candidate.
So you mentioned that you think most people have their own opinions for why this country doesn't always work so well. What are your reasons? What do you think?
Well, I think there's three main things that are all working together. It's kind of like a flywheel. And when you combine them, it's causing the sort of dysfunction we're seeing now, which is quite high. The first element is cognitive bias. We all have that. Human beings all have biases where you believe things in a certain way that support previous views, confirmation bias. We believe in sweeping narratives that might not be true. We're all susceptible to that. So that's not unique to one side or the other. The second factor has also been around for quite a while. That's the structure of our political system. So we've got two huge juggernauts, you know, the Democrats, the Republicans. They're in this big, bitter rivalry with each other. And that breeds more partisanship, more tribalism than if we had a multi-party system. You also have other subsidiary aspects to that, like gerrymandering, closed primaries. But the second element is the political system itself. And then the third factor is the new factor, the one that came about this century, and that's the new media ecosystem, primarily social media. So when you combine a population prone to bias, sitting in a political structure set up to increase that bias, and then you have all these people operating in the echo chambers of social media, which exacerbate biases yet still more, you get a lot of irrationality in our politics and a lot of people on both sides of the aisle believing things that aren't true, demonizing the other side, and so on.
Well, so what do you do about those things? Because as you say, we have cognitive bias. The two-party system, you know, there have been attempts to, you know, run third parties and, you know, have other parties, and they haven't really gone all that far, at least not in the past. And social media doesn't seem like it's going anywhere. So, like, what do you do about all that?
Great question. I wish I had an answer, and my book admittedly is more describing the problem than coming up with major solutions because it is so hard. I do think a really important step in that direction is just recognizing the root cause of what's happening in our country.
Do you get the sense that there was a time when people felt like this country was working well? Or is this something that in one way or another, for any number of reasons over time, people have always kind of felt this way?
There's, of course, always been some amount of angst, some amount of the country thinking things aren't working. We're, of course, always been biased. There's always been partisanship. And one really big question for right now is everything a lot worse now? Or because of new media, are we just aware of things more, right? Maybe the country hasn't changed much. We're just aware of it because we can see it more. We see the tweets. We see the videos on YouTube and so on. In my view, I think things are actually worse. And to answer your question, I think people did feel better about the country in previous years.
So understanding that, you know, as you say, your book is more sort of describing the problems than trying to come up with solutions. But I'm wondering, in terms of trying to get a handle on this, how much of the solution do you think comes from sort of politicians, political leaders, people in politics and government? And how much of it comes from us, those of us who are not those people?
It's a great question. To me, those two sides of the coin actually are one in many ways. That over time, the population, there is a lag, but over time, I think what's happened is growing irrationality in the population is slowly entering government more and more.
That's really interesting because I wonder if it's easier or more difficult to get the people in politics to change, or if it's easier or harder to get us to change, not just in terms of who we vote for and who we elect to those positions, but also, you know, the hundreds of smaller decisions we make every day that kind of lead to, you know, what we're seeing now.
Yeah, it's a great question. I think you've homed in on exactly where we should be looking and how we should be thinking about it. Trying to get large groups of people, and of course, our country's got 350 million people or something like that, trying to make big moves within the people is hard. I think if we're going to focus our efforts on improving things and getting more rationality and sobriety into government, I think identifying the right candidates, pushing them and pushing for them is really important. You also hope that politicians who are in power can do the right thing when it really comes down to it. But trying to get the right candidates into office and supporting them, I think that's where the focus should be.
All right. That is William Cooper. His newest book is called How America Works and Why It Doesn't. William, thank you so much for the conversation. I appreciate it.
My pleasure. Thank you.
If your mom ever told you to stop playing with your food, have we got an event for you. This week, about 40,000 cans are on display at Arrowhead Mall in Peoria, the 17th annual Canstruction Phoenix Metro Design Build Competition got underway over the weekend. In the past, competitors have built fairy tale castles, Dia de los Muertos, sugar skulls, and even the head of Medusa.
Wow. So this time, 11 teams of local architects, engineers, and construction workers recreated Olympic scenes in sculptures made entirely from cans of food. From skateboarding and surfing to ping pong and high jump, each team was given 8 hours to stack thousands of pounds of canned goods. You won't see depictions of athletes. You'll have to go back to the TV for that. But you can see these canned structures now through August 16th. And you can vote for your favorite online at canstructionphx.org. All the cans will be donated to St. Mary's Food Bank after the competition.
I like what you did there, Mark. You can see these canned structures.
Yeah, I thought that was fantastic. What do you think?
I can't believe you just said that.
And that'll do it for this Tuesday edition of the show. Thank you, as always, for listening. Don't forget, in addition to cans, you want to follow us on Instagram. We are at KJZZ The Show. If you got things that you're building out of random household items, we'd love to see that as well, of course. For Lauren Gilger and Sam Dingman, I am Mark Brody. Have a terrific rest of your day. Hope to have you right back here tomorrow.
Yes, we can. I know we can.